They emerged from 40 leathery golf balls. The squeaking triggers the other eggs to hatch and alerts their mother.
They are Cayman crocodiles, and they have a unique way of mothering their young.
The Cayman crocodile mother digs the 16-centimeter hatchlings out of the nest and carries them all to the river. She'll guard them all, night and day, for a few weeks. Crocodile hatchlings can catch insects and eat snails. Their mother, babysitting, will go hungry.
Wow, that takes selfless parenting to a whole new level. I'm Gina Kaufman. On today's Central Standard, we're exploring the role of motherhood throughout the animal world, because the human concept of motherhood may be unique, but it's not the only show in town. We've got a few experts joining us today to tell us about nature's many moms. I'm going to start by turning to Pauline Cartwright. Hi, Pauline. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, Gina.
Pauline's with us from the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at KU, and she's going to tell us about a fish called a hydrozoan. So tell me sort of generally about this creature. What does it look like? Where would I find it?
So, well, actually, it's not a fish. It's an invertebrate, but they're related to jellyfish.
And oh.
They're marine invertebrates, which live from the deep sea to the intertidal. And the actual group that I work on are called hydrozoans. And part of the reason why I study them is that they have incredibly diverse reproductive strategies and life cycles, and some of which is related to the theme of the show, which is how they take care of their young.
So, explain how that works. How do they reproduce? What's the story there?
So in general, marine invertebrates, the way that they would reproduce is called broadcast spawning. So they make a lot of eggs, make a lot of gametes, put it out into the ocean, and hope for the best. But what I found really interesting is in the group I study, which are cnidarians, so there's corals, there's jellyfish, sea anemones, and then this other group called the hydrozoans, is that in some really rare instances, instead of just spawning, they actually will brood their young.
So what does that mean, brooding?
Well, the moms will keep their eggs close, and fertilization will occur close to the mom, usually in inside a cavity, and then they'll keep their young until they're ready to live independently.
So then, what happens when they're ready to live independently?
So there's a few strategies, and I think it's very interesting. There's a box jelly that will keep their young until they're little larvae, and then the larvae swim away and metamorphose into another jellyfish. There's a sea anemone that will keep the juvenile anemone polyps on its body column and really protected by the mom's tentacles. And when the baby anemones are large enough to feed and protect themselves, then they'll detach from the mom. But they usually live nearby. And the group that I study, it's a hydrozoan called Ectoplura. What we discovered is kind of like the anemone, the baby polyps will attach to the mom. But what is unlike the anemone is they literally fuse to the mom.
So
their tissues fuse together permanently, and they become part of a colony of polyps.
So a colony of polyps, is that a single organism or many organisms?
That's a very good question. And I think even amongst us biologists that we often, argue about what that represents.
Which side are you on?
I would say it's a single individual, because if one polyp eats, the rest of them get the nutrients. So they're sharing these resources.
So let me get this straight. The mother, spawns these babies or polyps. What is the difference? Is a polyp its own organism at that point?
Yes, it is. And in fact, I just want to back up. A typical colony, like a coral colony, for example, does things very differently. They literally just bud new polyps. And this is a form of asexual reproduction. And there's just lots of polyps, and they're all genetically identical.
It's my understanding that most kind of crazy things a species does has something to do with its survival and perpetuation. How would you say that in this case it is the survival of the young, or is the survival of the mother that is being enhanced by this process?
In this case, it's probably both. Initially, it's certainly the survival of the young, because they can't even feed on their own. They don't catch food and they don't eat. And so as they're growing, mom's the one that's catching the food and providing the nutrients, because at that point, they share the same digestive system. Later on, you have an organism with multiple mouths that's increasing the chances that they can catch food and eat.
Whoa. So multiple mouths in a single digestive system?
Correct.
Wow. Okay. So does this seem to work pretty well for these creatures?
Yeah, I think it does. And in fact, if you look at this whole group of hydrozoans, this Ectopleura is one of the largest colonies, and it is incredibly abundant along shallow water coastal regions.
Does our awareness that the hydrozoan is capable of reproducing and rearing its young this way, does that change our understanding of biology and the natural world in any fundamental way?
Well, I mean, the one thing I love about science is the more you know, the more questions you have. And in this case, how do we define an individual that actually each of the individual members of the polyps are not genetically identical? So I think it does make us think about what we call an individual and how these polyps can coordinate even though they're not really originated from part of the same genome.
Are there other underwater moms, invertebrate underwater moms, we should know about?
Like I said, most of them really just spawn their gametes out into the water. Some survive, most do not.
But you win lose some.
Yes, exactly. But this brooding type behavior, which is rare in terms of species numbers, is actually common amongst the groups. So there are snails that do it, and like I said, there are sea anemones and various jellyfish and other mollusks that have this type of behavior.
What's your favorite thing about observing this process? I mean, is there something, some very specific aspect of it that just fascinates you?
Well, to study hydrozoans in general, what fascinates me is the diversity of approaches that they take, both in their life cycles and how they reproduce and take care of their young. And basically, the more I learn about it, the more different types of strategies that I find. In fact, what I often like to say is there's basically very little that a cnidarian cannot do.
Thanks, Pauline. Now, let's hear about another underwater creature, Leo Smith, also joining us from KU's Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. Good morning.
Hi, Gina.
Tell me about the cichlid.
So there's a lot of different species of fish will actually mouth brood. So this is where a parent will, after the eggs are fertilized, they'll either take the eggs or even sometimes the baby fishes themselves, and they'll hold them in their mouths to protect them. For the most part, in the fish world, you'll see that this happens where the male is actually the one taking care of it. But in the cichlids, both in Africa and South America, you'll have species where the mother will actually be the one that is sort of holds the fish in their mouth, you know, often for weeks. And then eventually, even in the South American ones, they'll hold the babies in their mouth for an additional amount of time after that. These are things like tilapia that we eat, as well as a bunch of the popular aquarium fishes, such as the angelfishes, discuses, Jack Dempsey's and Oscars.
People probably know what a tilapia looks like on a plate, but what do these cichlids look like in the water? About how big are they?
They're really, really varied in size and shape. So these can be as small as maybe an inch and sort of look like your standard, what I refer to as like a Joe fish, you know, like average looking. They can go up as the angel fishes can be almost like a kite or diamond shape. And then you have big round discus. And the largest cichlids are probably, you know, approaching maybe a foot, maybe 15, 16 inches long.
Are all of the fish within the cichlid group, are they all pretty similar in their mothering style, or do we need to distinguish between them?
Right. So that's a really good question. And it's actually one of the reasons why so many people study cichlids. So most fish, it's not entirely all that different than what Pauline talked about, where they'll kind of just spread their sperm and eggs all over and they'll fertilize and they'll go off into the wild. When you get into cichlids, most of them have like a sticky egg. So they'll actually deposit their eggs either in a nest or on a structure, and then the male will come by and fertilize them. In the case of cichlids, once as you sort of go into the different sort of groups of cichlids, you sort of repeatedly evolve mouth brooding. Sometimes that'll be where the mother takes care of them. That's sort of the dominant case in cichlids. But there's also cases where the male does it, and there's some where the male and female do it. But
so primitively, they... Yeah, describe it in a little more detail, though, this mouth brooding. So that's basically just keeping your babies in your mouth?
Right. So in the female mouth brooding ones, so the mothers that we're talking about today, the mom will lay down the eggs like sort of in a on a surface or something like that. The male will come by and fertilize them. In some cases, the male will actually fertilize them while they're in the mouth. And the reason for this is to try and ensure that, like, at any given time as these animals are reproducing, they're vulnerable to attack because they can't defend a territory, or something could come in because the eggs are so nutritious, or, you know, a delicacy, or however you want to think about that. They're trying to protect every last egg, right? So they're going to take every, and that sort of conveys as they go into the mouth brooding. So after they're fertilized, she'll like literally hold them in her mouth. Some fish are capable of eating while they do it. For the most part, most don't. So they're going to have, the mom is going to like, not waste away, but she's going to have a serious hit to her nutrition. She's going to start starving for 10, 14 days. And she'll just be rolling them around in her mouth, sort of keeping them from getting fungus or anything growing on them. And she'll actually be able to somehow tell. We don't really know how they do this, but the female can tell which ones are fertilized and which ones aren't, and she'll slowly swallow all of the unfertilized eggs.
Whoa.
And so that's kind of interesting. And then on top of that, if a large number of them get sort of taken during that initial phase, somehow if like 10 or 20 or 30%, if it's not a very successful reproductive effort, she'll actually swallow them all and do the process, start the reproductive process all over. There's some sort of cue that if it's not going well, they know it and they don't want to delay reproduction for that year.
This might be kind of a big question, but what accounts for the differences in mothering styles across species? I mean, just that some creatures are having tons of babies they don't even know, and others are investing a lot of energy into like a couple of them. What accounts for all of these kinds of differences?
It's going to just be natural selection. So natural selection is going to favor one group. So if you have a group in it and that where they're all sort of something in between, I mean, primitively everything broadcasts spawn. The simplest creatures on Earth will reproduce their, you know, release their eggs and sperm into the water. And then over time, if one group has more success because they take care of their young, you'll see a gradual increase in parenting, but only in cases where it sort of increases the survivalship of the young into the next generation. But you can see why that would happen. I mean, if you can get a couple, ensure that a few make it, you're going to have a lot more, you know, you're basically guaranteeing their survival.
Can you talk to me a little bit about the movie Finding Nemo? What kind of fish is Nemo? And is that basically a story that could really happen minus the talking and stuff?
So Finding Nemo is that's a clownfish. And clownfish are actually really closely related to cichlids. And so they have similar sort of reproductive behaviors where they have these sticky eggs where the parent will take care of the eggs. The complication in Finding Nemo and the reason it might not sort of work long term is that instead of having males and females like we normally sort of imagine as humans or mammals, the largest clownfish on any sea anemone is a female, and all the other ones you see there are male, with only one of those generally reproducing with the female. And if you manually pluck out the female from the population, the largest male will transition, because they're hermaphrodites, it'll turn into a female, and the second largest male will become the breeding male. And so in Finding Nemo, what would generally have happened would be that when Coral, the mom, dies, Marlin, the father, would then become the mom, and Nemo would then start to mate with Marlin.
That is a pretty wild story. William Leo Smith studies cichlids in KU's Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. Now we've got a guy who can talk to us about lots of mothering styles from the animal world. He's the director of living collections at the Kansas City Zoo. Sean Putney, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Is there an animal at the zoo whose mothering style has really caught your attention?
Well, I think when we talk about mothering styles, it's interesting to hear the other guests talk because we have things that they are working with at the zoo, too. So it makes sense to me when we're talking about this stuff. But we have a wide variety of animals at the zoo. We have our own mouth brooders and cardinal fish, Bangai cardinal fish at the Hillsbird Penguin Plaza. We have jellyfish there as well. They don't brood, but the moon jellies are a relative of the hydrozoans that we were talking about before. But the ones that really seem to grab everybody's attentions are the ones that are more closely related to us, like the orangutans and the chimps and the gorillas.
Tell me about the orangutans. I am guessing that we have more in common with them in terms of mothering style than with the hydrozoan or a cichlid.
Definitely. The orangs are very similar to us in that they put a lot of energy into their young, and they are very caring. They'll take care of, they'll usually feed their infants for up to 5 years. They might hang out with mom until they're 13 or 14 years old. So there's a lot of care that goes into that and a lot of energy as opposed to a coral that's just releasing their gametes into the water. So there's definite benefits of it, but there's a lot of energy that's being put into it.
Do you have any stories about parent-child relationships in the orangutan world?
We do. We do. In fact, Kaylee John is our youngest that we have at the zoo, and it's an interesting story. Zoos have evolved with the times, and over the past 30 or 40 years, it used to be if a mom wasn't taking care of its youngster, we would immediately pull that animal and hand raise it. But we found over the years that that can harm that animal as it gets older because it feels like it's more human as opposed to being an orangutan. So when Kaylee John was born, her mom wasn't taking very good care of her. And so we did make the decision to pull her. And
can I just ask you, what does it mean for an orangutan to not take very good care of her young? What did that look like?
For her mom, it was she put her on top of her head and just kind of had her there for a while. In fact, we let her try to do her thing for a while, but there was no maternal instinct at all. And she had had babies in the past before and had similar things. So this is kind of her last effort to try to be a mom. So she wasn't doing a very good job. So we inserted ourselves, and we did 24-hour care on her. We wore little hairy vests to act as if we were orangutans ourselves. We did that for about 6 months. And at the same time, we were training one of the other orangutans that had been a mother before to present herself up to the front of the holding exhibits so that when the time came, our plan was to reintroduce her to this surrogate mom. And it was obviously she didn't have a baby at the time, so she did not have milk, so we'd have to get some nutrients to her. So our plan was to train mom at the same time we were trying to get baby to the point where she could hold on and do the things that a young orang would do. But mom would have to bring her up to be fed on a regular basis. So our whole goal in the thing was to make sure we got the mom to the point where she was ready to be a surrogate and the baby to the point where she was strong enough to hold on, fend for herself. And that was about 6 months. We were one of the earliest to be able to put a youngster back with a surrogate. So we're really proud of that.
So the idea of maternal instinct is kind of interesting because that implies that just across species, you're born with this just you have an inborn ability to know what to do when you step into that role. And it sounds like that's not necessarily the case. Like sometimes you need help.
Definitely. I would say it's very similar to us in this circumstance, especially in that some animals do a very good job at being moms, being dads, and others do not. And we step in when we feel we have to. But the overall goal is to try to get the animals to be the best parents that they can. Now, that being said, there are some animals, as the previous guests noted, that there's no parental instinct at all. If you're a coral, if you're a frog, a toad, most frogs and toads are just laying their eggs and off off on your own.
Does your work at the zoo observing other animals give you perspective on your own human relationships, even your own family relationships?
I would say it depends on the animals. Certainly, when you start looking at the primates and the great apes specifically, yes, you can see that there's a great deal of similarity between the two. And yes, it's really nice and neat to see how well they take care of their kids. But there are differences too, especially with the orangs and the chimps. We have a young chimp right now out on an exhibit, and they have to fend for themselves pretty quickly. They have to hold on. They're very strong. If they fell off, they have to be more durable. So there are a great amount of similarities. And yes, I do think about that stuff sometimes, but there are also a lot of differences.
Part of what I get from your stories and our other guest stories is that parenting, I mean, I think human parents think of their challenges as very particular, like it's challenging because of hectic schedules or modern demands or things like that. But it's fascinating to me how challenging parenthood is for other creatures, too. It's like that it's hard work and things go wrong sometimes.
Yeah, the difference is it's hard work in both circumstances, but if the parents don't do a good job for these animals in the wild, their offspring probably won't be around very much longer, as opposed to us making a mistake here and there. We have a lot of backup systems in place, so it's very brutal in the wild. So if a chick is left unattended or a young orangutan is left by itself, chances are nature's going to have its way.
Do you have a favorite mother-baby story from your time at the zoo, something like really cute and cuddly for us to go out on?
I think I just told you my
the cutest, cuddliest,
the cutest one that is dear to my heart. But I did just tell you also about our chimpanzees, and they are a very dramatic group. But it's interesting to watch how not only mom is taking care of them, but the entire troop, how they interact with each other, and it's very much like relatives coming in to see one of our kids in the hospital when it was born.
Tell me about it. Describe it in some more detail. What do they do?
Well, mom is very protective, and she'll sit there and she'll allow some to come by and see. There are others that she might be more wary about, and then gradually she'll kind of increase the number of animals that she'll allow to come over and see. So it's almost like original family, close family, and then extended family, and then relatives, and then it goes on and on. But it is very interesting, very, very dramatic, and very close-knit group.
Thanks for heading in from the zoo this morning. It's been fun talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
Sean Putney is the Director of Living Collections at the Kansas City Zoo. Next on KCUR Central Standard, we'll listen back to a conversation about hunting fossils around here. We originally aired that discussion in November of 2015, but it's inspiring us right now to get out and enjoy the outdoors this spring. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned.
It's just me in the park today. No one playing on the equipment or fossil hunting.
Some people send their interns out for coffee. We send ours fossil hunting. Kyle went to Brookside Park yesterday to look for remnants of ancient life that we'd heard might be embedded in the rocks right by the playground.
In this big brown gray rock, I found a darker gray lump. Looks like some sort of seashell or the top of a croissant with tight ridges. I dug through the app, and my best guess is Cincinnatina miki.
The app Kyle's talking about is new. It's called the Digital Atlas of Ancient Life. It works like this. You're holding something you suspect is a fossil in your hand. You pull up the app. It shows you a set of images, and you click on the one that most closely resembles your find, like a suspect lineup only for fossils. Each time you make a choice, you're presented a new set of options, narrowing down the possibilities. If you don't see anything on the app that vaguely matches your fossil, there's a good chance that what you've got in your hands isn't a fossil, but just some litter caked in dirt or something like that. Hey, you gotta find out somehow. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll be talking with the co-creator of the Digital Atlas of Ancient Life. Bruce Lieberman is a paleontologist at KU. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi. Great to be here.
Did Kyle use your app correctly?
Yeah, he did. Actually, that's really great. And the potential identification that he had is a very plausible one. And one additional thing I could say that he could have done is that when he clicked on that species, there's also a map function. So you can click on the map and see if that particular type of seashell, in fact, it's a brachiopod, had previously been found in that area. And that could help pin it down a bit better. But he used it exactly the way we were hoping it would be used.
What is a Cincinnatina miki? Tell us more about that.
Well, basically, a lot of the life forms that you're going to find in this area, the Kansas City metropolitan area, both on the Kansas and the Missouri side, lived about 290 million years ago. At that time, this part of the United States was underwater. And so there's a rich profusion and variety of marine organisms that live there. And one of the main things that we focus on are the organisms without backbones or invertebrates. So the type of thing that he found, in a way, it looks quite a bit like a clam, but actually it's not a clam. It's a brachiopod. It's got two shell valves, and there's sort of a mushy thing inside of it, just like clams, but they are fundamentally different in their structure.
What's the big difference? I mean, in terms a layperson can understand.
There's two ways that I like to try and describe it, the differences. The first involves the shell. So if you happen to have a clam and you looked at it, where the two valves meet, it's almost like that's a line of symmetry or a mirror. And on one side, on each side of that line, you'd see a shell that's pretty much identical. But in the case of the brachiopod, where their valves meet, that's not the line that they're symmetrical. Rather, sort of, if you did a perpendicular line to that, it's on either side of that line. So it's not across the different valves, but between the two valves that they're sort of mirror images of each other. And then the other difference involves the soft tissues. Now, rarely would we find those in the fossil record, but inside of a clam, there's a big muscular foot that they use to move around. And that's actually the part for people who like to eat clams, especially fried clams, and I'm one of those people. That makes really good eating.
The tasty part.
By contrast, yeah, that's the tasty part. Exactly right. The other bits, not always so tasty, I must confess, inside of a clam. By contrast, in a brachiopod, though this is a judgment call, there really are no tasty parts. There's no big muscular foot. And that, partly because of this, brachiopods, once they land somewhere, they can't move around much, or at least most brachiopods, whereas a clam can move. Instead, in the brachiopod, there are these two little whirly structures, and that's how they sort of they filter in water and catch tiny little organisms on those whirly structures. But most people, maybe nobody, would want to eat those.
So they still exist. They just happen to, like, not so much here, except in fossil form.
Yes. And so, like, that particular species is no longer alive. All the species that we find in these rocks around here have been dead for hundreds of millions of years. But the major group that they belong to, the brachiopods, is still around, but they're a lot rarer than they used to be. Sort of almost what Kyle was doing was really, in a sense, when you look at a bed of rocks that you see in a park or anywhere else, in most cases, what you're really doing is it's almost like you're walking down an ancient beach or seashore that existed hundreds of millions of years ago. And today, if we're at the beach, we'd be walking on the beach picking up shells. Well, what he was doing was picking up shells that were on beach hundreds of millions of years ago. And that group that species belonged to, the brachiopods, is still around today, but they're a lot rarer, actually. Whereas, by contrast, back then, the clams were pretty rare, and today they're more common.
What inspired you to think about creating new technology for amateur fossil hunters? I mean, there's kind of a conceptual disconnect, in my mind anyway, between connecting with 21st century technology on a cell phone and digging for remnants of ancient life in the dirt.
You're right. There is a disconnect. And it was kind of a variety of reasons that inspired us to do this. So first, we were funded by a National Science Foundation grant. And really, one of the aims is that at the University of Kansas, at our Natural History Museum, and indeed at many museums, natural history museums throughout the country and even the world, there are literally and figuratively tons and tons of fossils that are present, but they're present inside of, they're in drawers and cabinets that really nobody can access unless they were to come to visit Lawrence, the Lawrence campus at Kansas, which of course is a great thing to do. I would really encourage everybody to come visit, but sometimes that's just not feasible or possible. So partly what we were doing with this project was making the contents of these drawers, the fossils that are present, and also where they occurred or where they were found, rather, so available to researchers throughout the country and throughout the globe. And when you do that, it makes it possible to do studies like to look at how things like climate change affect species through time. But by the same token, we also recognize that a lot of the specimens that we have inside of museum drawers, just like scientific researchers can't access them, the general public couldn't access them either. And we know that there's really a large variety of people who are interested in paleontology. And we don't like to call them amateurs, actually. The preferred term that we use is avocational paleontologists. And the reason why we use that is because sometimes, or really maybe a lot of the time, the amateur paleontologists are better at finding fossils than we are. It's just they usually don't get paid for it. So we thought that, hey, a lot of this material that we have in drawers could be of interest to somebody who's interested in fossils in Missouri or Kansas, or even teachers and for their classrooms in Missouri and Kansas, really to provide information about the fossils, where you can find them, and what they look like. And ultimately, we put the information first on the web, to provide information on the fossils and also things about the species evolution and their ecology. And then really the decision to make an app was partly inspired by the fact that we recognized a lot of times when people come into contact with fossils, they'll typically be outdoors, and they might not be in a wireless zone, or they're probably not, and they might even be outside of cell phone coverage, or at least data access would be expensive. So we wanted to make it possible for people to identify the fossils they collected out in the field in real time. And that's sort of how the genesis for the app kind of came to our mind, and we were hoping that it would ultimately come to fruition. And thanks to the help of some great programmers and other folks at the University of Kansas and the other scientists that I was collaborating with, ultimately we were able to do that.
You know, can we talk about this whole amateur versus avocational thing for just another second? Because the word amateur, I mean, maybe some people think of that as an insult, but I think it's kind of a compliment, because the root of that is like amor, like love in Latin. And so it's like people doing something for the love of it rather than for financial compensation. And I wonder if through that lens that term bothers you as much, because I kind of like it and I kind of maybe want to keep using it, but I don't want to offend you.
You definitely aren't offending me. And, you know, that is a really good I like your use of the etymological root there. And I didn't think of that. So actually, you're right. So please go ahead. Anybody use the term that likes it. I just didn't want anybody who might be called an amateur to feel offended if I use that term. Because sometimes, you know, there's that sort of attitude of, oh, leave this to the professionals. You know what I mean? So,
well,
yes,
I
think that
you can keep
the
using
term amateur is great by me.
Okay.
I'm totally cool with amateur. I just didn't want to sound like a haughty paleontologist by using it.
Well, no. I mean, now that we've got our terminology clear, as a professional, what do you think is the role of the amateur or avocational fossil hunter? I mean, presumably a professional doesn't need the app, so you must see some value in other people also taking an interest in this stuff.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So one of the things that really has kind of exploded on the scientific scene in the last few years has been the opportunity to do what are referred to as citizen science initiatives, which basically means that ultimately information that are collected by the general public or amateurs can be used by scientists. And the truth of the matter is that a lot of the time I won't have the opportunity to go out in the field. In fact, field collecting is not my main focus. I do it sometimes, but it's not my primary focus. And it's often those people who, as you said, they're amateurs, they're really passionate about it. They'll be out collecting at localities when it's snowing, and they'll be using a broom to sweep off the snow so they can collect more fossils. So one of the long-term goals that we hope to ultimately use the app, and this will require a bit of modification, is to make it possible with the appropriate permissions for various folks to add new information, maybe new occurrence or distribution sites for the fossils, or perhaps new species that are recovered as well, so that that information could be directly uploaded. We're not quite there yet, but at least we saw this as a way of maybe making a firmer and easier means of interacting between amateur and the paleontological community.
Where are you from originally?
Originally, I'm from New York City.
On the face of it, that is a pretty unlikely place to become obsessed with the wonders of the natural world. How did you become interested in fossils?
Yeah, that's really a great question, Gina. So what happened was my parents, when I was 3 years old, took me to the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, and I fell in love with the Tyrannosaurus Rex specimen. This is in an amateur sense. I fell in love with that specimen. I became so passionate about paleontology that I kind of made my parents take me there at least once a week, probably much to their chagrin. And so really that was sort of what ultimately got me interested in paleontology as a child. However, as I grew a bit older, I was sort of totally committed to the field of paleontologist and had my heart set on becoming a paleontologist. But sort of by the time I became 10 in my teenage years, I sort of left that idea behind. But then I took an awesome class when I was in college offered by a very famous paleontologist, Stephen Jay Gould, and that sort of rekindled my interest in paleontology, and it sort of changed my thoughts and ideas about what paleontology could do. When I was a kid, I was really just fascinated by the magnificent animals, the dinosaurs, these giant mammals that you'd see in the museum, and it was almost, in a way, it's like seeing a prehistoric zoo. And you got to use your imagination to really think about what these animals would have looked like. And by the time I was in college, and especially after taking this course, I realized that what we can study in the fossil record really can make important contributions to the field of evolutionary biology. And that's sort of what rekindled my passion, because I became very excited about using fossils to study evolution in deep time.
In your own experience, have you gotten to do a lot of fossil hunting yourself, like a lot of field work?
You know, I have. As I get older, the amount has lessened. I don't know if that's on purpose or maybe it's just me becoming more practical. But I have managed to do some field work, and especially when I was in graduate school and early in my professional career here at the University of Kansas, I did do quite a bit of field work. And in a way, it was pretty awesome. Some of the places that I was able to go, I've been able to go to the Canadian Arctic and also collect in fossil sites in Nevada, New York State, West Virginia, even done a bit of fossil collecting around Kansas. But it hasn't been the main focus of my work over the last few years or so. And that partly was a decision based on the fact that, gosh darn it, we have so many fossil specimens already collected that haven't been analyzed, that we've got in our collections that are valuable, that I thought, hey, maybe it would be time to focus on what we've already got
But do you remember your first find? Like the first time you found something as a professional that really excited you?
Yeah, I actually do. It was when I was in graduate school, and my thesis advisor was Niles Eldridge, and he and Steve Gould were the ones who developed the idea of punctuated equilibrium. So he took me on this fossil collecting trip.
And punctuated equilibrium, that's just the idea that evolution kind of goes along fairly undisturbed for a while, and then a major change happens, and then that equilibrium again.
Yes, that's exactly right, Gina. So it's sort of the notion that species are stable, and then there'll be a burst, a relatively rapid interval of new speciation. And Niles Eldridge had first provided evidence for this idea by looking at trilobites, especially in some of the fossil localities in New York State. And these localities are a bit older than the one, at least the ones in Kansas that we did our app on, about 100 million years older. So I was really excited because I was heading out there to try and find some of the trilobites that that ultimately the punctuated equilibrium theory had been developed based on. And I got out of the car and there was this sort of rubble heap, and I found a head of a complete, fairly rare trilobite right on the top of this rubble heap. Now, the rest of my time out on that day, we really basically spent looking for my advisor's lost dog in a swamp. But it was finding that trilobite head that really kind of jazzed me, because I'm like, hey, I can actually find something. It made me feel good.
Talk to me about Kansas and Missouri from a fossil hunter's perspective. What's out there for local fossil hunters to find, and how did it end up here?
Well, both Kansas and Missouri have great fossil deposits. And they represent in some respects different time periods. So sort of especially as you get further east into Missouri, east of the KC Metro, it's somewhat of a different area than what you have in the KC Metro and west. But at the time that the fossils that we focused on were deposited, this was again about 290 million years ago, most of North America, not all of it, but most of it was under ocean water. And Kansas and Missouri would have been close to the equator, actually a little bit south of the equator. So a sort of a setting that at least periodically was a very tropical marine environment. If I was
Sounds
trying to
nice.
Think of what it would have been nice. The sort of the closest thing would be something like the Bahamas, maybe, or the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. So very different from what we have today.
Just ahead on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll bring an amateur fossil hunter in on this discussion. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. Now let's welcome Brent Jackson to the conversation. Brent and I go way back. He's kind of a jack of all trades, but one of his many active hobbies is fossil hunting on the amateur level. No insult meant by that. Hi, Brent. How's it going?
Hi, Gina. How you doing?
Bruce was just telling us about some of the fossils that are plentiful in the Kansas and Missouri landscape. Have you found any of the things that he was talking about?
The brachiopod's pretty common, and Bruce's focus is on the invertebrates, and that's what I first saw growing up. If you live in Kansas City, you're aware of shells in our sedimentary rocks. I mean, I think any kid sees that, and I saw
that.
It
kind of freaks out.
Yeah, it's very strange because you're like, why are these shells here? And I wasn't really into fossil hunting beyond just like seeing those shells. And then I think when we were, I don't know, I was like maybe a sixth or seventh grader, we went to a road cut, and then we were doing fossil hunting
as
a field trip. And that's where I think I found my first crinoid, which actually I brought a bunch of crinoids with me here.
Yeah, you've got a whole tub of things you found.
So these are crinoids.
It's a little jar.
And they look
like dog food, actually.
Well, yeah, you kind of see them. I mean, they're different shapes. They're different sizes. And I guess they're technically, paleontologically, they are sea lilies, if I'm getting that right.
But is they're that right,
yeah,
Bruce?
That's absolutely right. Yep, he's right. Absolutely right.
So they're the most sort of common kind of what I would call, for me, I'm not a professional.
That's why I was worried. I see when that term professional, it sounds so bad.
Okay.
Of you as
well. It's one of those things that the crinoid is the coolest of the dull fossils you find. So it's like if I find a crinoid, like, well, at least I found a crinoid, and so that's not the most exciting.
It looks kind of like a little tube.
Yeah, and some of them are quite small, and you know some of them are large. But I didn't really think of fossil hunting as a concept until I was out in college. I had a friend who lived near Great Bend, Kansas, and I came upon this storefront where somebody was preparing a fossil, and it was just the strangest thing. And I later met the man who was this fossil hunter, and he was not an amateur nor a professional. He was a commercial fossil hunter, which is its own population. And he also, I would say, had some sort of unconventional and perhaps even antagonistic views to the professional paleontological community. But he was the first person I ever met who actually, you know, he described fossil hunting like fishing. Like he had fossil hunted in western Kansas, where you're going to find like large fishes and sharks and things of that nature. But he also had gone to South Dakota and pursued Triceratops and T-Rex and all that kind of thing. And so it was the first time I ever had seen somebody actually doing that. I thought you had to have a PhD in paleontology to find fossils. And then I saw, oh, well, you know, people can find it. And the truth of paleontology is that it was originally all avocational. It was just people who were outside wandering around, and then they found something anomalous.
Yeah,
and
like
it was
weird,
a
that looks like a head.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing for my interest is, because my interests are primarily literary, it's like I didn't know that there's this whole cultural side to fossil hunting, and it's actually very important to our national history.
Explain the cultural side. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's the famous fossil, and it's my dream fossil, which I've never found. It's the thing I'm seeking is the mastodon tooth. There's a mastodon tooth found, I think it's in New Jersey, in the 18th century. And it was called the incognitum afterwards. They didn't know what this thing was. And there had been a French scientist who had been sort of diminishing the American people, the idea that like anything on the American continent was inferior to Europe. And so then they found this tooth, and they thought it might be a tooth of like a biblical giant or something like that. And it became a cause of celebration. George Washington was very interested in it, and then Thomas Jefferson, he became obsessed with the incognitum. So fossils are not neutral in our culture. They have a pretty interesting and sometimes very volatile history.
You know, I'm wondering if you look at your surroundings differently as a result of your fossil hunting experience.
Oh, absolutely. Because it's and the thing is, I'm interested in the Pleistocene, because the nice thing about the Pleistocene is it's also a time when there was human contact. So Bruce may have to correct. I think a fossil has to be 5,000 years old or older. Is that right, Bruce? Do you know that?
10,000.
10,000,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, you're very close.
Okay.
On the geological
five,
time.
5,000, 10,000. Okay.
It's nothing.
So, yeah. So, but the idea of, you know, Kansas City has been, to the archaeological records, been inhabited for 2,000 years straight, and then evidence of 5,000, and then the record gets fuzzier. But sometimes if you're finding a bone, you know, that could be very, very old. It was also when there was, you know, human contact. So that's kind of a cool element as well. And it starts changing. A lot of times in the Midwest, we don't really see ourselves as, well, we sometimes have poor self-esteem because we think nothing was here and nobody was here. But there were people here, and there were also woolly mammoths and mastodons. And there's a bison called the bison latifrons, which is this gigantic buffalo with a 6-foot horn spread, and it makes things exciting, I guess.
Bruce, what's something a beginner might have some luck finding in our area, and do you have some pointers for how to begin?
Yeah, you know, so I do think that sometimes the vertebrates are more spectacular, as Brent was talking about, and the Kansas River is a good place to look for those. The invertebrates, however, are extremely common and very easy to find. So like Kyle at the top of the program, really any place that you can find the yellowish-brown layered rocks in this part of eastern Kansas, western Missouri, they're literally packed with fossils. So a lot of times you'll sort of see them, people have them stacked around the back of their basement, and also in places on the sides of the road. Those are really good places to look for fossils. Anywhere you see those yellow layered rocks, one of the things that we always emphasize to those, definitely around roads, to be very cautious.
Yeah, definitely, and there are common sense.
One thing I should say further, on interstates where some of the best road cuts are, you aren't allowed to stop. But around smaller roads, you know, if you pull your vehicle off to the side, or just in parks, like where Kyle was, really any place you see those yellowed rocks, they're literally going to be packed with things like clam or brachiopod shells. And if you get a little bit luckier, you could find crinoids, or what I kind of think of as this, you know, the second most cool fossil after the vertebrates, to me, are trilobites. But I understand where Brent is coming with the crinoids.
Trilobites are cool. They're hard to find in this part of the country. They're harder to find.
But literally any of those yellow rocks that you find around this area packed with fossils, then you'll sort of, a lot of times you'll see these yellow rocks and then there's sort of like a set of black shales that are interbedded with them. They usually have grass covering them, especially in the spring and summer. Those can have fossils, but they're a lot rarer, and also they're more likely to be plant fossils. So I'd stick to the yellow ones just because really high probability of finding something. Really, in fact, you just have to look down and you'll see the fossils there.
Brent, very quickly, do you have any favorite fossil hunting spots you'd be willing to share?
Yeah, if you go along the Kaw, there's a group called the Friends of the Kaw, who's a canoe group. They've really kind of tried to increase the access. You can start at Kaw Point, just in downtown Kansas City. There's a access point in Edwardsville. There's an access point in DeSoto. And usually there's just a sandbar or gravel bar, and you just start walking around and looking for something.
Brent, this has been fun. When are we going to go fossil hunting together?
Just tell me when.
Should we bring Bruce Lieberman's app along to help us identify things?
Yeah, I wish I had used it earlier, actually.
Bruce Lieberman, paleontologist and co-creator of the Digital Atlas of Ancient Life app. It's been great talking to you this morning.
Thank you. My pleasure, Gina.
And thank you, Brent Jackson. He's an amateur fossil hunter. That's a wrap for today's show. You can listen to any of our shows at kcur.org/centralstandard. So if you missed something last week, like our discussion about the proposed streetcar expansion, you can find them all there, kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, Mark Bittman is going to tell us how to grill everything, plus how gifted programs are changing in the school systems. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Today's broadcast had contributions from Andrea Tudhope, Kyle J. Smith, and intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.